Blog Talk Radio.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it's that time again on a Wednesday evening at 9 o'clock p.m. on the Blog Talk Radio Network. This is the one and only K. Thompson Live Show. I am also known as Asana. My name is Eric Payne. Some of you know me as Citizen Payne. And
hey.
You are.
Yeah, K. Thompson. Hi, Citizen Payne. What's up?
Not much, Ma. What's going on?
Oh, a lot of things. There's a lot of things in the world. Welcome to the world. Listen, tennis, I have to say this, Venus was beating the heck out of several people. she is really, okay, really, really, and they're holding her own. Also, there are four black females, you know, in the top slots, Sloane Stephens, Venus Williams, Madison Keys, and, well, I'm counting Serena, even though she had a baby girl. So, but they're all playing pretty great tennis. So, congratulations to them. And I was spending time, you know, watching them. Mainly, I didn't have to deal with anything Trump-a-dum, you know? So, but what's new?
Not much. We're going to go ahead and welcome our resident guest, Mr. Byron Saunders. How you doing, Byron? What's going on today, brother? Hello, Byron Saunders. Is you there? All right, maybe not. Your mic is open, though, Brother Saunders. Okay.
Were
you talking? Okay, it sounds like
I'm here. Yes, I'm online. I hear you nice and loud and clear, and you know, with keeping in prayer, my friends in Puerto Rico and St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, and Houston area, as these storms are bearing down on our country. There are three hurricanes, all bearing down on our coast here. So we got some issues coming up.
Right, that's very true. We do, and also want to keep Bermuda in our prayers as well, and Houston and all those areas. That's right, we got three big storms coming, and we had before that we had race riots, and
yeah.
The people that watched Game of Thrones said winter is coming, and Trump got things into the White House, and I guess winter has come with all of that stuff, you know, going on. You know, we got this guy at the helm who wants to kick people out of the country, wants to kick the dreamers out of the country. So I'm not sure of what sense it makes to decide to kick kids out that have been in this country since for a long time. And that we've educated, you know, this country has educated a lot of these kids that are dreamers. A lot of them are very productive citizens, full-fledged Americans, culturally American, as far as they know. And I don't see what sense it makes to ask those type of individuals to leave the country. I mean, I have thoughts on immigration and things like that. Like, one of my questions is, I don't understand how you can live in a country for 20 years, 20, 30 years, and never get around to getting your citizenship, you know, but. I'm sure there are some reasons there, but I think that a lot of Americans who are kind of conservative in that perspective, and as far as that subject is concerned, I'm sure that's one of the questions they have. Like, you've been here for 35 years. How come you haven't taken the necessary steps to go ahead and be a citizen? And that's a question that I have. I bear in mind that the fact that the people asking that are immigrants to this country themselves, even though we might be immigrants, you know, further down the line. But there's only one group of people, I guess, that can claim to have been here indigenously. That's the Native Americans. So everybody else is new to the country. Although some members of our country want to claim that they built the country all by themselves, and we all know, all those of us that are educated, know that that is not true. But you know, that's one of the things. And the crazy thing is, he's going to kick the dreamers out, but then he's going to move it to Congress, let Congress fix it, which is Kind of sounds like a Trump CEO move. Take responsibility for nothing and credit for everything.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Eric, because critically, we didn't vet Trump. And had we done so properly, we would have discovered, as we're discovering now, that the five bankruptcies that he took his own company through, and the fifth one was he defaulted on his own loan to his campaign. But he's doing the exact same things that he did to those five bankruptcies that he's doing to America. There's no difference. This is not a good businessman. He is not a deal maker. He's a pimp. He's a charlatan. And we could have avoided this had the media properly vetted him during the election cycle process, and they didn't. So they're now finding out exactly just how bad a businessman this person was, and we're paying the price for having had at least the fourth estate not do their job properly.
Well, I think that they vetted him. They vetted him to the point where he was good TV. And
that's,
I think that's
all they
did. The extent of their – And you know, the first people that come to mind are Mika and Joe, you know, in the morning, the Joe Scarborough show, and they're all upset about him calling them out, and he was calling her out and doing all this. But when they were having him on the show consistently, giving him a platform consistently, it was all hunky-dory. Everybody was all friends. See, I'm the type, and if I don't like your program, if I don't like how you're living your life, if I can't agree and it's not about liking or how someone's living their life, but if I find someone that I happen to be social with to be a racist, to be prejudiced, to be a sexist, a misogynist, then I'm probably not going to really look at them as a friend, right? I'm probably not really going to try to hang out with them unless there's something that I want. And everybody wants to hang out with somebody rich, right? This is America. We're built on a capitalistic society, which is part of the reason of the allure of Donald Trump, the businessman that he sold to all of these poor people who believe that, because we worship the almighty dollar in this country. So when you have someone who's a rich friend, one of the main things you want your rich friend to say to you is, I'm rich, let me make you rich too. You know, and I jokingly say that, that seems to be the allure of wanting to hang out with them. And Mika and Joe, I have no respect for them. I really, you know, in watching the show, and I understand a lot of these shows are supposed to be Democrat, Republican, point, counterpoint, pro-con, right? Get it. Yeah. But when I first started watching this show and hearing Joe Scarborough, who's this Republican, you know, he was one of those conservative guys back in the day when he was in the House. I would watch this woman, Mika Brzezinski, who was the daughter of Dr. Brzezinski, who was, I think, Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State. What tripped me out is that she was just looking clearly. I'm not surprised they fell in love and they're going to get married, because the way she used to look at him on the show, every time he used to be saying crazy stuff, she'd just look at him like, oh, Joe. That was the impression I got. But anyway, let's bring in our co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman.
Hey, Eric. Your mother used to look at me that way. We're not married.
What?
Oh, my goodness.
Is there something
I've tried, you know, but, you know, I just want you all to make me rich now that I know you two are in a position to do that for me.
At least you guys were in the same Democratic Party, had the same Democratic views.
Yeah, and I looked at her too, you know, so what can I say? Anyhow.
A little bit too much TMI for the sun, bro, but that's okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I won't let him, Wayne.
What I find it to be very easy for these for those diametrically opposed political perspectives, you know, when two people get together, opposites attract, whatever. But I don't find that to be the case. I don't find that to be the case usually in African Americans. I don't see the Democratic brother dating the Republican sister. You know, I just don't see that happening.
Eric, you need to get out more.
much
yeah.
less having
Thank
a show.
You.
I mean, I haven't seen the show that I like because I'm looking at, you know, we've talked about Joe and Mika, and then What's-Her-Face and Carville come to mind. And
Oh, yeah, yeah, right, right.
They kind of.
Yeah, you don't even
like,
hear about them anymore. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I saw them in, I saw them, they did All the President's Men Revisited. I think it was last night, you know, where they broke down the film about Richard Nixon and did a documentary about
right.
Nixon. I guess it's around the anniversary or they're getting close. I guess they're doing that because I guess Trump is getting ready to be impeached. I don't know. But they had those two on the show. But I don't see how, you know, for me, you know, someone politically opposed, and if I meet an African-American person talking, really supporting the Republican Party, when you really think about what they stand for and what they're co-signing on, I can't get with it because they're co-signing on the detriment of your people. So how can you then be for that? But obviously we see examples of that. Look at Uncle Ben and Auntie Omarosa and
right.
Uncle Clarence and all
that. And
there
are a number of them out there. And there are some that are, you know, if you don't mind me interjecting here, but there are some that will give you a critical analysis of Donald Trump, and there's some that will, you know, favorably, and then there's some that will just distance themselves. Well, I'm not that kind of Republican. But by and large, when you see how this party votes, the obstructionists that went on during the Obama years and everything else that goes on, you know, you can't help but feel that they're you kind of question, well, what planet are these people from? You know,
yeah.
why is it that they don't understand DACA? You know, it's amazing.
You know, I think it's amazing that they are trying to destroy what Obama put in place. And Trump wants Obama's name out of anything. So he's got big problems, you know. So, but anyway, listen, I wanted to say, too, we're waiting for Dr. Len Jeffries to call in because he is scheduled tonight and he has some very interesting things to say to us. So, but there's so much in the news, my goodness gracious. And with the people who are, you know, without housing, we also have to find out ways to get a lot of, you know, information to them and clothing and to, you know, start movements of food and whatever.
Can I pick up on what you said,
Go ahead. Yes.
You and Wayne, you said something, too, that I kind of forgot. What it was, but about Trump, and if it pops back into your mind what you said, I wanted to spin off on that. But also, as you said, that Trump is trying to dismantle everything that Obama does. You're exactly right, Mom.
Yeah.
He just trashes Obama every chance you get. He trashes. You've never seen a president trash their predecessor as much as Donald Trump does. But we know that he's a criminal and he's a liar, and he's going to do whatever. I think that it all boils back to the correspondence dinner when Barack just ripped him. And I know you guys know that dinner I'm talking about. When Obama just ripped
Absolutely.
Trump, and people were laughing at Trump's face. He looked so ridiculous, and Barack was, you know, and this was after Trump really was highlighting the whole birther issue and picked up the mantle of the birther issue and just, you know, blew it, took it to the next level. And you know, it was, I guess, maybe 2 years before the presidential election, and Barack ripped him nice. So maybe that's what it is. Trump wants to, besides having that envy, he wants to dismantle everything that Barack Obama has put up. Unfortunately, he's dismantling for everybody. He went against his own party today with the Democrats.
Eric, one thing that happened today, which is extremely interesting, is the move that Trump made to seal the deal of increasing the debt ceiling and the emergency monies with Schumer and Pelosi, bypassing the entire Republican Party. He, in effect, threw the Republican Party under the bus in one swift move because the debt ceiling is now extended for 3 months, which takes it beyond the midterm elections.
Right.
They don't come
yep.
back. They get 12. The Congress is and Senate are in session for 12 days officially. And at this moment, that happened today. he set a deal with the Democrats.
Right. And he, and I tell you, I'm glad you brought that up, Byron, because, I mean, to a certain extent, he yielded on the side of political expediency. He knew that there would be hell to pay if he didn't come up with some funds for them people hurting down south and whatever impending crisis we have on the horizon with Hurricane Irma and all that. And,
And I
was watching some of the talk shows, including Scarborough this morning, how they were, you know, poo-pooing the Democrats, and they come up with this twist, like as if we were dead set against wanting to help people. And if you look back in history, when we were going through our own crisis here with Hurricane Sandy, people like Ted Cruz and all the others stood by and they said, you know, they said what Gerald Ford said to New York at that time, 25 years ago, New York had dropped dead, you know.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought that up. And it's just so, it just goes to show the kind of player Trump is, you know. And he'll just do things that make him look politically expedient, like as if he's savvy. And to me, it's just nonsense. It's garbage.
He will sell everybody.
It really
he
is.
Will sell
and here's something else to consider. He's out there selling the tax breaks, but when you look at the reason why Houston is in such trouble that it is, it's because they gave the corporate community there, the oil industry, the energy industry, and pharmaceutical industries a free pass on taxes so that they relocate their businesses there. So Houston now is the fourth largest city in the United States. And the market, this is where it gets crazy. The Wall Street is being buoyed by four main industries, tech industries, insurance industry, energy industry, and pharmaceutical industry. Three of the four are about to catch all hell. The insurance industry can't afford the bailout that's about to hit this country. The pharmaceutical industry, Puerto Rico is the pharmaceutical capital of the universe. That's where all their major locations are. And
where?
In Puerto Rico, that's right. And now you've got the energy. If any one of those pipelines coming up the East Coast are damaged again, like they were in Houston, we're up a creek without a paddle. Think about that, because gas prices have already spiked almost a dollar.
Exactly. Right.
And what's about to hit is worse than anything we've ever experienced. And if those three industries fall, Wall Street fell 200-plus points yesterday. Do you think that they're on the verge of a serious meltdown? If those industries fail within the next 2 or 3 weeks, this country is in trouble, and a recession is going to hit us hard because we're printing paper. We don't have the resources or the money to back the paper.
Right.
There's such a debt crisis right now that any little thing that happens tips the scale will send us into a recession worse than we've ever had experience in this country.
And I might add that has been going on since the time George W. Bush was president.
Emptied the treasurer. That's right. He did it in 9 months, and Trump is doing it in 7.
That's right. And then they'll turn around and still try to give tax credits to the wealthy.
And still try to give tax breaks. How you give tax breaks to the industry that's already been given more taxes at breaks than they need to? You don't need to be an Alan Greenspan to figure this one out.
Exactly.
So
we have
some major issues that are confronting us economically and then of course with the hurricanes. My God, it's heartbreaking, folks.
Flip side of that too, as you're saying. The flip side in terms of in Texas, you know, you got those super funds, you know, those polluted plants that they've allowed, you know, this guy who's head of the EPA who acts like there's nothing wrong with the environment, not going to do anything to protect the environment. And Texas is one of them. Now Texas is up a creek because, pardon the pun, but because, and I don't mean to laugh about it, because they've allowed all these pollutant chemical companies to run roughshod and do whatever they want to do. like they had the,
exactly.
the representative on the news the other day, and the guy wouldn't tell anybody whether, you know, are these the chemicals, are they noxious, are they toxic? He wouldn't tell anybody.
He couldn't even identify.
The news broadcast, he revealed that it's in the law that they don't have to tell anybody the way they designed this law for these people. So, I mean, you know, Texas had Governor Rick Perry. Now they got Abbott. And you know, you kind of reap what you sow. You know, karma, you know what they say about karma, you know. And,
yeah.
Right.
And like Ted Cruz and that, like you brought up. Ted Cruz
yeah.
was one of those. All of the entire Texas delegation, as a matter of fact, was against the aid after Katrina for up here. So they all voted against it, from what I've heard on the news. And
yes,
so,
they did.
You know, it's
yes,
coming
did.
Back to get them, except for probably Sheila Jackson Lee and any of the members in the Democratic side, but certainly all of the
Republican
delegation
for sure.
on there. They were all against.
And then, of course, we're focused on what's going on in Korea and then expecting China to intervene on our behalf when China and mm-hmm. both Russia and China have borders on North Korea? I don't think so. It's just, that's
you know,
just foolhardy.
You know,
it's never going to happen.
Do you know one thing? We are going to be responsible for destroying the planet. All right?
Yeah.
DeGrasse, you know, the guy who was, he was saying that we're just, you know, throwing out questions. He said it's hard to turn Mars into Earth. And he said, he's about when will humans disappear from Earth? Now he's raising the questions
right.
of, you know, longevity mm-hmm. and the weather, you know, and the destruction of Earth itself. And it's a real, real serious problem. And then they also, there's a question about, astrophysics. I forget about what that was, but he was wondering about the length of time that human beings would have on Earth, this planet. So it's a very real possibility that the Earth may destroy itself from inside or outside.
Well,
so we've got to get serious about preserving what we have.
Or
you
want to get a glass of water, or man may destroy the Earth. That's
yeah.
what we're doing. And you have these people that are very selfish individuals, you know, these usually very wealthy, not caring about anything individuals, who think somehow the destruction of the planet is not going to affect them
mm-hmm.
and pollution is not going to affect them. They're going to be sort of very rude awakening. But Byron, you made a point about, you know, Korea bordering with Russia and China. You know, I heard a report today that said that trade with China and Korea, if within the last year, North Korea increased 23%.
Right. Yeah,
so
exactly.
They don't seem to have any real concern about getting this guy under control with his craziness, you know. And obviously, Trump was trying to do business with China, and he's trying to do business with Russia, you know, Trump Tower and all that. So he has no vested interest in holding either of those nations' feet to the fire in terms of reeling in North Korea. So, you know, we're dealing with someone whose true allegiance is only to himself and to his family, which leads
exactly.
me into the next segue of his son going before the Senate committee. I guess it's going to be staffers questioning the son tomorrow, right, about his lies, about the lie about the meeting with the Russian people when he lied and tried to say it was about adoption, when it was really about trying to bring down Hillary.
Yeah, I think one of the things we'll discover with the impact of Mueller's subpoenas are taking on Trump's empire, their financial empire, and that's what's going on right now. If you notice who's being subpoenaed to come and testify, everybody in his circle but Trump. And that's a strategy it's a military strategy to back your enemy into the corner and then reduce their exit options. And
right.
those
yeah.
exit options are being taken off the table one by one by one. And they're going to force him to make a choice. Either he resigns honorably, they'll strip him of his wealth, because that's going to be what's the biggest thing that's going to happen as a result of his laundering, 30 years of laundering money. And they'll strip him of his wealth, but the reality is this: if he stands his ground, he will go to jail. And if you take the nuclear option, which is a black ops operation, they will take him out of that office under handcuffs if they have to. But that's
explain
that's,
that
that's
again,
support.
Byron. Explain what you mean by.
Black ops operation. Because he's now think about this. He surrounded himself with generals. These generals hold no allegiance to the commander in chief because they didn't get their stars from him. Their stars came from the federal government. And there's always a military code of honor and respect that you owe your allegiance to where you got your stars from. And ultimately, each one of them have taken an oath to protect the country by way of force if necessary. They are generals. And if this need be, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who are all of your Army, Air Force, Marines, the combined armed forces have to, they will step in and take out anyone who's going to damage this country. It's just their code of ethics.
There was something in the paper today about Kelly's role. Apparently, is it Schiller or one of someone is just dropping the dime about who's preparing to leave the administration, and they looked at Kelly and they said he's only doing this because of honor and respect for the Constitution and the United States, not that he's doing anything on behalf of Donald Trump.
No,
so
he's not.
I guess
you're
absolutely right. The fix is already in, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the thing is,
with the option, the second option, of course, is allowing Trump will stand his ground, and then, of course, the subpoenas will become more like indictments, because there's criminal violations, and then that engages the country in a constitutional crisis, which ultimately, the Constitution will stand its ground itself. But it's going to take – because of the depth of the treason, and it goes all the way up the Republican Party, all the way to Vince Priebus, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, Rubio. They all got money from the Russian oligarchs, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so and it becomes – now, and I'm going to say this, and it's, I'm nothing racist about it, but white men in particular will stand in your face and tell you we have all the information on you to take you out. Now it's your choice. Here are your options. And it's very clear that's a military strategy. And if people don't understand it, it's because they haven't really been paying attention to America's history. Even in the Civil War, you have to remember Robert E. Lee was a graduate. He was the superintendent of West Point. And the people who took his surrender were his classmates. There's honor and code in military that goes way beyond anything that this country understands, and especially for someone like Trump who, deferred in his commitment to serve in the United States military.
Also, you're going to talk about, too, the career of the infrastructure people who've been serving the government, just like you said that the military people have. You have people that are career government employees or workers, members, people who have been career FBI people who work within the FBI, the CIA, all aspects of the government, Secret Service, certainly all of the intelligence agencies that he's been straight up disrespecting from the time he took office. So, you have those people that refuse, the hold of those that are still held over from the Obama administration, from the Bush administration, from the Clinton administration, people that have been in these positions. So he's going to have very little accomplices left over. I mean, you see they just got rid of his body guy, his personal security guy that Kelly got rid of. So, they're, like you said, slowly, one by one, they're not allowing him. Because remember, I was talking about him trying, it was a race. He was, I brought this up before, he was trying to put all of his people in place that are going to be down with his conspiracy and his coup before the justice and before the people who are really trying to serve the country could get their stuff together and combat Donald Trump, which is why, you know, he's gone through so many, you know, Comey and then the guy after Comey and this guy, you know. That's why he's gone through all these people, because he wants their loyalty as if he's the Don, you know. And I'm not talking about the Donald. I'm talking about the Don and the guy. You know,
right, exactly.
And the one place that rarely works is when you run up against the federal government, who has a bigger organization than you have, you know.
As of today, Eric, the vice chair of the Federal Reserve is turning in his resignation by the end of October.
Right.
All right,
see,
then.
I didn't hear that one.
Yes, sir. That's happened. That happened as of late, of about 5 o'clock this evening.
Really?
So wonder now. I mean, the thing is, I mean, we have to look at Pence also, because, you know,
Absolutely. He's
likely to inherit. You know, I mean, not to say that he is worthy of inheritance at this point, but at some point, if we have to follow the process, he's going to be next in line. I mean, we see him already acting very presidential.
Except Wayne,
really?
He's implicated. He is also implicated in
the Russian.
Well.
Oh, okay,
so
all right.
It ain't happening. Okay, the only one on his administrative council and staff right now who is pretty much outside of any indictment is Orrin Hatch.
And not one of my favorites, but that's interesting.
I know.
To see.
Mine either, but yeah, he's
But
everybody else
get him caught up in that.
Yeah, but those guys have been consistent, Hatch and what's his name, Lindsey Graham, and you know, I have to say that they had been always critical of Trump, you know, but they cowered into the party line business when they realized that he was going to be the next man in charge, and that's it. And McDonald,
you know, Wayne,
I don't know what the.
Wayne, you bring up an interesting point, because now the question becomes, now that Trump made the deal with the Democrats and it's obvious he is fighting against his own party for the next however many months, the question comes now is which GOP congressman or senator has the guts to call for the impeachment, because there will be no legislation passed. Forget about the tax cuts. Forget it. The debt ceiling has already been extended 3 months, and that was without Republican vote whatsoever. So you tell me, in the midst of this midterm election, because every Republican who has no relationship with Donald Trump right now as a result of the fight that's going on in the inner party and the infrastructure itself, that they are looking at their midterm elections and saying to hell with Donald Trump, and if this is CYA time, you know what CYA time is. And at the point at which somebody's going to have the backbone in that party to stand up and call for impeachment procedure. That's how it's going to go down.
McCain, he's the only person I could think of right now, and it's sad what is happening to him physically, but you know, he's got the backbone and stamina to do it.
He's got the backbone.
John McCain.
But also the thing is that it would have to be. I think it would have to be. I would perceive it to be someone from a state that's a purple state, as opposed to it's a deep red state, and particularly a deep red state where the base is supportive of Trump. Right? They just had two of their Congress people that are not going to be seeking re-election. The Republican Hispanic woman from Florida, she's got three names. I forget her name. I heard someone on the news today that she's not going to be trying to run for re-election. And then there was a moderate Republican. These are two moderate Republicans, as a matter of fact, allegedly. There's a moderate Republican out of the state of Washington who was a well-known sheriff, which is how he got his reputation up there. And he's not running for re-election. He's a sheriff. Republican who was a former sheriff out of the state of Washington. I don't know his name. But he decided not to run for re-election either. So these are two moderates, which means that those districts could potentially be up for Democrats to take control of. which we're going to take back, and we need a lot more seats than that. But, I mean, if that could be the beginning of some sort of snowball.
Change, yeah.
Rolling, we could really be in a good position.
Well, that, too, has already happened. 3 weeks ago in the Iowa special runoff, a Democrat took a House seat. So it's, they're picking them off one by one. And that was in Iowa, okay?
And Iowa traditionally – Iowa has been, well, I would say more purple than red, you know. I mean, even Obama carried Iowa back in the day. So, I don't know.
Right.
I guess they weren't feeling Hillary at the end of the day. But I could be mistaken. I know that you know, it's just interesting how they sway that Midwestern mentality in terms of what they're looking for. And As I'm listening to you guys, I was just watching something in the finance section of the of my internet page here, how many of Donald Trump's supporters who were seeking work were getting less of an opportunity to find employment than those who supported Hillary Clinton during the course of the campaign last year. In other words, all those who were out of work seeking jobs and got better paying jobs as a result of their, not as a result of their support for Clinton, but just the whole dynamic of what's going on with the employment process in this country. And those who supported Trump are not feeling any of the impact of the many things that he promised that he would do. So,
right.
You know, it's been 7 months already, but time is already telling. And it's happening fast, way faster than I thought it would.
Yeah, well, that's where their prejudice has come in to bite them in the you-know-what, right?
Because right.
They were blaming Obama for that. It's just a matter of a lot of these people that are in that group, that area, if they weren't employable before Trump got in office, what makes them think they're not going to be employable now? Which, I mean, if they had some skills that they needed to refine and to improve, and they didn't improve them, they just elected the other dude, I don't understand how they figured that life is going to be automatically better because the brother's not in there and because the woman's not there.
That's amazing. You're absolutely right, you know. And, that's common sense, but, hey, common sense isn't always common.
And sometimes hatred clouds your better judgment, right? I mean, if you grow up with a false sense of superiority and you grow up within a society that's fed you this myth that I am better, you know, and this is what happens, you know, they get upset. This is why Black history is American history. It should be taught across the board, because then maybe you don't get these people growing up thinking they're superior, and when they don't achieve the superior things that they think that their superiority should get them, they won't be as upset. And I have a fix, I think, for those non-college degree educated white dudes. My fix is, we'll send you all to community college, help you get an associate's degree, so you make better decisions.
Yeah.
You know, because the mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Right.
So because you're in that. You know, you didn't go to college, you're in that high school graduate, not really, but I'm that dude, let's help you out. Go to college, get a degree, make better decisions, you know?
I hear what you're saying, I'm feeling you, but, you know, I who live in a college town part-time and see what goes on with some of these white folks who come from parents of means and all that, and just see the level of degradation that happens here, it just never ceases to amaze me. You know, it's there is a certain mentality, and I'm sorry, it's fostered at home. You know, there is this feeling they want you to feel like as if they're inclusive, but deep down inside, you know, the vast majority, and I want to paint with a broad stroke, but from what I could see, you know, they've been just indoctrinated by what their parents believe. That's it. And I'm talking about one of the most prestigious liberal institutions on this side of the Hudson River. You know, I mean, it just amazes me. But it is what it is.
What institute is that? Would you like to say?
Well, I okay. For full disclosure, I live in New Rochelle. There are three colleges here: the School of New Rochelle, which is run by Catholics. I own a college which is in my backyard, you know, literally in my backyard, one block away, and Monroe College, which is a bit more diverse, but you still have an element there of people who, you know, spend upwards of $40,000-$50,000 a year at all these institutions, you know, and they just have this attitude about them, like as if, you know, and I'm sorry to say this. I mean, if you want to take me to task, contact Kate Thompson Live, and we can talk about it. I see what goes on in front of me, you know.
So you're saying they come across entitled because they come from family of means and,
exactly.
and things
I mean,
like
the,
that,
the,
and also
and it's just the manner in which once they've gotten away from mommy and daddy, and you see some of the nonsense that they get away with. If you and I, Byron, or even your mom were to go into one of their neighborhoods and do what they get away with here or attempt to get away with here. It's just fascinating. And I always say that if I lived at 3rd Avenue and 149th Street in the hub of the South Bronx and this activity was going on and we all looked like people of color, because that's all that predominates down there, minus the gentrification that's slowly taking place in the South Bronx, the police would act differently. I've seen it with my own eyes, you know?
Right.
But because these people have fathers or mothers who may be tied to somebody's employment, you know, and I'm saying, I'm just speaking how it is, you know, I'm just, you want to take me to task, call K. Thompson Live, and we'll go toe-to-toe as to what goes on there. And there is an elitism amongst them that just, I don't see where that's being taught at school. This is just how they're reared, you know, and that's
right.
It. So,
I wonder if you take individuals of that same ethnic group that you might happen to be referring to, that are not, don't come from means, the people who come from hardworking people, who come from poor people, that group that I talked about, that if they could go to college, I wonder if their perspective would be a little bit different, because perhaps what might supersede the feeling of the urge of racism and prejudice is when you walk the same walk as some people. And maybe, I'm sure probably there would be some sort of classism. But I wonder if the awareness and the perspective, if you take an individual who's grown up poor, who's grown up the hard way, doesn't come from a family of means, you put him in a college environment where he can improve his mind and broaden his horizon, depending on the college he goes to, right? Because if you go to Brigham Young or one of those colleges, I'm sure the curriculum is a little bit different than probably more of the liberal arts colleges. But I wonder if you take that individual and you put him in an environment, would his perspective about the world change? You know, would it? Because he's not coming from a background of entitlement.
Yeah.
He's coming from a background of hard work. So I'm wondering if you take those kids, and let's be plain, those white kids, put them in an environment where they can improve themselves, and would they act differently? I'm not talking about the entitlement and the wild stuff they would do with the community, which they often get away with. I'm talking about how they would perceive and value this opportunity for an education, and would it give them perspective about how they see the world, and would it, in fact, enlighten them to the world? It's just a question, I guess.
It's an honest question, Eric, and I often wonder about that, because, I mean, there are some that will stop, and they, you know, obviously they come, not every person who's white is living on, you know, an annuity that their grandmother left them of $250,000 and stuff like that. You know, I mean, a lot of these people, you know, are struggling, and they come from families who struggle, but some have made it. But it's just that, you know, the discipline and some of the antics that I see, and this is, I mean, when I first purchased here, I wanted my parents to move from Bedford-Stuyvesant to come to this community. Not so much I wanted to be here, but I thought it was safer than having to look at the police blotter at the morning and mornings when I go into WLIB and BLS and see, well, this person got murdered on Nostrand and Fulton Street, or this person was stabbed in Prospect Park walking, and my parents thinking it's 1949 and they just arrived and things are safe in Brooklyn. So lo and behold, I mean, my lofty ideas about getting them out of the so-called ghetto at that point, because Bed-Stuy was still predominantly black, changed when I got up this way, and I just felt that this might have been a safer environment. I'm Catholic, grew up that way. I'm in the heart of a Catholic, in the shadow of a Catholic institution here, Iona, and the church is right down the street. My neighbors used to be like Ruby Dee, God rest her, and Ossie Davis.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, this isn't the, I mean, it's like upper middle class, but still, you know, you have the dregs of society on the periphery. But it's no different than where you are, you know, just that it's on this side of the Hudson. But it's just that the mentality and trying to reason and rationalize, because the very kids that I talk about, I was once their age too, but I couldn't act. I couldn't bring myself to be disrespectful or to talk back to somebody older or somebody in a position of authority. I might have wanted to, but I do know what would have happened if I had done so, you know? But but you raised a good point, Eric.
I mean, it's about how you're raised, too. I mean, you wouldn't have done that because you were raised better. And also, just a point, a side note, I guess, you moved out of Bed-Stuy to get in a safer neighborhood, and Bed-Stuy is a safer neighborhood now, bro. Stuyvesant Heights. It's Stuyvesant Heights now, man. It ain't Bed-Stuy no more.
you're right. My sister, I mean, she's still there. That's the only one left. And that's a whole other story. But the neighborhood, you get off the subway at Utica and Fulton Street, and the subway opens up to Fulton Park. I don't know, Byron, if you're familiar with that. But when I was a kid, you would sit at the rail and you'd watch all the pretty black women coming out of the subway station and hope like hell you could latch on to one to, you know, have a date with or go out with, form a relationship. And when I go there now, if I happen to take the subway, and there's nothing but whites, three-piece suits, business people of money, you can just smell wealth coming out of the subway. And it's only because it's a 20-minute ride to Wall Street. And, you know, it's deep. And as I said, that neighborhood, like Harlem, at one time were the most concentrated areas of black life in this country during the 60s and 70s. You know, it's lost now.
It is.
Some of us
it
have
is.
Sold out.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't my intention to have my parents sell, but I certainly thought they'd be safer living outside. I still maintain
Absolutely.
That to a certain extent with what I still see go on in Brooklyn today. But it is what it is.
I was over in the Bed-Stuy area 2 weeks ago, and you're right, Wayne. It's and I was there early in the afternoon and late in the afternoon, going towards evening, and the number of businesses that have gentrified that community in the Bed-Stuy area, it's now Bed-Stuy Restoration is fighting for its life to maintain the growth and development of that community.
Interesting. Wow, that's amazing. And that's that's a historic institution by itself.
Exactly.
You know?
And then when you add Weeksville to that mix, because Weeksville historically was started as an African-American community in the late 1800s as a place where African-Americans, freed African-Americans, could own their own property.
Right,
The history of Brooklyn in Weeksville.
Yeah.
Which is a byproduct of the Bed-Stuy community, right? You know, it abuts it, but it's still, you know, and they've had to fight to bring back their institution as a historic landmark, and it's still there. It's thriving. It's staying afloat and alive, but it's like the history of the Brooklyn community, which, like you said, at one time was second to the Sugar Hill and the community of Harlem, where the brownstones represented an affluency to the African-American community.
Right, right. And the thing is that And it's our pride in redeveloping those neighborhoods, because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, black folks were the custodians of what happened in Bed-Stuy and in Harlem. And as soon as white folks picked up on the fact that, you know, it's taking me too long to ride in from Bayshore or the Hamptons to get into my job at the city, and I could just hop on a train if I were living in Brooklyn, all of a sudden Brooklyn regained its status and its improvement again. But the problem is that the developers have taken this thing for a touchdown. And I was just watching the mayoral debate on TV a moment ago, and I think that there should be some discussion about gentrification and its impact. I see it in Newark. You know, I remember, over at Rutgers, the campus there, I taught there a couple of summers, and I was, you know, grateful for the opportunity and really exposed to some things that I didn't know about, you know. And I know Kay could validate some of the experiences, you know, with people protesting to make sure that campus, stayed intact and that people of color were given an opportunity to attend that institution. But, you go to Rutgers, I mean, you go to Newark now, and you see the same slow gentrification process suddenly taking shape. You know, depending upon, I don't know Jersey that well, I don't know Newark that well, but I do know whenever I've gone there, just even going to the last event I attended, in which I saw you guys, you know, that building was closed. The old, it's not Bamberg,
the old Haynes,
what was it?
The old Haynes building.
Yeah, yeah, that was closed for many years, you know?
Right.
And
right.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
I'm not saying the change isn't good.
Well, as long as everybody takes part in the change, everybody is able to benefit from the change, right? And what we want is that our people and our neighborhoods and our culture is sustained. I saw I was watching a short film on the ABF channel, American Black Film Festival channel, and there was a short film that this woman did about View Park, Los Angeles. It's a black section of Los Angeles, middle class area where there's black home ownership. Kind of similar to the areas that you talked about, it was in L.A., so it was more suburban, but there were homes. And this was an area that was traditionally for black people predominantly lived in this area. There were homeowners. It was a nice class of African-Americans, middle class. And now they're talking about that is being gentrified. There's a lot more other people moving in, buying homes there that are cheaper. And this particular film was a short film addressing that very same factor and how some of the people wanted to promote that more African Americans buy, and if you're buying homes, that this is a community that might be appealing to you to move in, to have people, you know, your own kind of culture. And one person in the film, one of the people in the film said, you know, when white people talk about it, they're preserving their culture. When black people talk about it, somehow we're being racist or prejudiced. You know,
exactly.
That's a very good point. You know, I mean, you know, people have worked for a long time to develop these areas. I mean, because those were the areas left to us. And then, like we do, we make the areas hot. We make it popping. We make it the place where everybody wants to be. And, of course, people eventually start to move there, right? And you also have to add in the fact of immigration in this country, right? People coming from all parts of the world and that are coming from places in the world that are doing a lot worse than the United States. And moving in the hood with some black people probably is not as bad as living in a war-torn country, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, you got people moving, say, hey, at least there's no bombs dropping next door. So this is fine. I could deal with this, right? So you combine that with that, and that helps to water down or transform the cultural makeup of these communities.
As you said in the very beginning, Eric, I think, honestly, as long as everyone gets a stake in it, when it becomes lopsided, it becomes a problem, you know?
Exactly.
Because we still have a homeless crisis here in New York, and I don't know what they're going to do to address it, because the more the developers come in and kick out, you know, people who they're paying them. you know, I know of somebody who's being paid $20,000 to move out of an apartment in what is that, down there by Spike Lee's place, Fort Greene in Brooklyn,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Lived there 30-some-odd years, and the landlord is anxious to sell and is paying them that kind of money just to relocate, you know?
And then when you look at the growth and development of Williamsburg, it's mind-blowing.
You remember
Williamsburg 20 years ago, it was a dump.
Oh,
okay?
It was. You're right.
That's right. Now, you go over there now, the gentrification process that is taking place along that corridor of growth and economic development for the Brooklyn community is amazing.
Yeah,
stunning.
Right.
Yeah. And as we talk about this, not to radically change subject, but something Eric said a moment ago about immigrants and stuff like that, what is your take on this whole statue business and particularly the Christopher Columbus nonsense that, you know, it's in the news now, and I realize a lot of this started with Charlottesville and all that, but, you know, I don't know
consider this, Wayne, because the issue is about the nation, our nation's perception of equality.
Yeah.
And if you allow the statutes to be the perception of existence long past the person who's alive, long past the rationale for why it was put there, but if it's a perception of a false equivalence, then it continues to exacerbate the lie. It continues to keep
right.
it afloat. You have got to tear down the lie. In fact, I was happy to hear Trump mention George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, because just 2 weeks before he mentioned that after Charlottesville, did he not read the article where at Thomas Jefferson's home they discovered the room for which Sally Hemings lived in his mansion, which was next to his bedroom with no windows and one access in and one access out? Now, let's be honest about the call of Sally Hemings as a mistress. That's a lie.
I hear you.
He raped her.
Only a black woman
can
do
rape.
That. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Exactly. So, and here's something else to understand. The civil rights movement was successful because Martin Luther King and SNCC and Fannie Lou Hamer and Edgar Meadows, they made a conscientious choice to make the fight against the bathroom, the water fountain, the lunch counter. Because had they chose to do equal employment, housing, fair housing, public education, I mean, and let's face it, they never would have won anything.
Right,
because
right,
of the
right.
fear factor. So engaging the civil rights movement to engage the water fountain, the bathroom, the lunch counter was a simple place of perception to get our people, African Americans, involved into a movement of liberation and freedom. And you got to remember, the first time that Martin Luther King said he was going to go to Chicago, the black ministers told him, "Don't bring that radical stuff up in here."
Right. Now we got to put a pause in the bio because we're just about ending the show. We got about a minute left, and I agree with that. And also too, you're right. They had to make it about, and I think that's how they got the broader community involved, because they made it about common everyday issues that every human should be able to take advantage of. The lunch, the water fountain, the bathroom. But we got 60 seconds. We got to wrap it up. This is the time flies when we start talking about these issues. This has been the K Thompson Live Show. Want to say goodnight to our resident guest, Mr. Byron Saunders, Brother Saunders.
Peace and love.
There it is. Peace and love. He's short, sweet with it. In his, not your stature, brother. I'm talking about, you know, the way you put things there. And Mr. Wayne Gilman, legendary newsman, sir. Once again,
I
want
to thank
real.
You, and I look forward to continuing on the soapbox next week with you guys. Hopefully, we can this back up again.
Yes, sir. All right. Thank you, Wayne Gilman. Once again, this has been the K Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can hear us every Wednesday live, 8 to 9 p.m. Chronicles of Archive. I am the Sun. My name is Eric Payne, and you are?
And I am Kay Thompson. Join us every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on Kay Thompson Live, Blog Talk Radio.
There it is. Thank you, everybody. Got to go. Trying to find the outro music. There it is. We got the outro music for y'all. Thank you.